This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
You're listening to the FT Money Show, brought to you by Investors Chronicle and FT Money.
Hello and welcome to the FT Money Show. I'm Richard Anderson from Investors Chronicle.
And I'm Charlene Goff from FT Money. And together,
we'll be bringing you this week's financial lowdown in downloadable form from beside the River Thames this week. I'd like to say, because the weather was so beautiful, but unfortunately we couldn't actually get into the studio. So shivering aside, Charlene, what have we got on the show this week?
Well, today we're really fighting the consumer cause and revealing dodgy business practices. Coming up, we ask why mortgage providers are claiming that they've scrapped exit fees when in fact they're simply renaming them, whether investment trust boards will keep their promises in buying back shares, and how you can avoid getting stitched up when paying with credit or debit cards overseas.
And if you've got a subject you'd like us to tackle, you can email your questions to ask.ftyourmoney@ft.com. But first, we're going to take a quick look at insurance premiums, which have shot up in the wake of recent floods. So, Charlene, what's been going on?
Well, at the end of last week, we saw Norwich Union, the biggest home insurance provider, increase the prices of its policies by 10%. That basically has come in the wake of the recent flooding, but it's not just for people who have been hit by the floods, it's across the board. So even if you're living in a sixth-floor flat in London, you could end up paying more for your home insurance.
And how on earth can they justify that?
Well, they've said that they were reviewing their prices already and that they were planning to put them up. They said prices have remained pretty unchanged for the last 10 years, so they're well in need of an increase. But insurance brokers are saying that, you know, they are having to pay out a huge amount for flood damage, and that's likely having a big impact on the decision to raise prices.
Exactly. Yeah, it all sounds a bit too convenient. So we've talked about Norwich Union. Are there any other big names that are going to follow suit?
Well, no one's actually said anything officially, but insurance brokers do expect a number of other big insurers could also put their prices up. But it could also be an opportunity for some of the smaller providers to undercut Norwich Union and basically reduce or make their products more competitive to try and win a bigger share of the market.
So what should people do if they've suddenly been landed with a massive premium, especially if they don't live anywhere near water, let alone floods?
Well, really, the market is so competitive, there's lots of opportunities to get a better deal elsewhere. No insurer can put up the price when you're within a contract. It's really at the end of the contract. So if you see a big jump in your premiums, you should contact an insurance broker or look online where you can probably find a cheaper deal.
And remember, you can get all the latest money news at ft.com/money.
Still to come in the programme, will investment trusts buy their own shares to stop prices falling? And why you need to think twice before paying with a card on holiday? But first, the FSA has been putting pressure on lenders to scrap these charges. And while many have done so, others have just renamed these fees or introduced other new charges in their place. Richard spoke with Ray Bolger at John Charcoal Mortgage Brokers to find out more.
Ray, I guess it's pretty self-explanatory, but could you just explain exactly what exit fees are?
The exit fee is a fee that a lender charges when you finally redeem the mortgage, not to be confused with early repayment charges, which relate to charges if you redeem during a deal period. Lenders have a variety of names for exit fees, but colloquially, most of us in the industry refer to them as exit fees.
And are they always made pretty clear when you, at the outset when you first take out your mortgage?
This has been part of the problem. If a lender charges an exit fee, they have to state it on the key facts illustration. However, until the Financial Services Authority made a comment in January, lenders were often increasing their exit fee between the time when somebody took out a mortgage and the time they redeemed it. And what the FSA have said is that although lenders can do that, they can only do it if they make it clear how any increase will be calculated. So lenders now must either charge the exit fee they quote when somebody takes out a mortgage, or if they want to charge more, they have to state clearly how any increase will be calibrated.
So this is the problem the FSA has. Presumably they don't have a problem with exit fees per se. It's just the fact that they can change during the period of the mortgage.
Well, the FSA has two problems, really. One is that they can change. The other is that they haven't in the past really had borne much relation to what they're supposed to cover. So what the FSA says is any fees must be reasonable in relation to the cost of whatever service they're meant to provide. Now, most people don't believe that it costs lenders over £200 in admin charges and admin costs when you redeem the mortgage. So that's the other part of the problem.
So what exactly have the FSA told lenders to do?
The FSA has given lenders a number of options. One is to charge no exit fee. Two is to state clearly on the KFI, the key facts illustration, how much the exit fee is, and if the lender wants the option to increase it, to state how that will happen. And the third is simply to charge whatever exit fee they originally quoted. Well, it's got to bear in mind here that people will be redeeming mortgages that were taken out before the FSA started regulating mortgages. So some people have had old-style illustrations rather than the new-style KFI. And if you took out a mortgage several years ago, it is very probable that either there was no exit fee at all quoted on the illustration, or if there was one quoted, it would have been much smaller than today's figures.
So are lenders actually listening to the FSA and doing what they're asked?
Lenders have no choice. The FSA is the regulator, and if you don't do what you're told, then you get more than a rap over the knuckles. So that's why we saw a lot of announcements towards the end of July from lenders stating what they were going to do, because the FSA gave lenders until July the 31st to tell them what they were going to do in terms of exit fees.
It sounds like some haven't been particularly upfront as they could have been. I've heard some examples of mortgage lenders simply renaming the exit fee but actually not changing it or scrapping it at all. Is that right?
That's absolutely right. Essentially, lenders have, in the main, done one of three things. Some have scrapped the exit fee completely, and although the number of lenders who've done that is relatively small, the amount of new mortgage business that's written by the lenders who've done that is actually about 50% of all new mortgage business. So that's obviously a very significant chunk of the market. The second category have reduced their exit fee, in most cases to somewhere in the range of £125 to £145. And that suggests that they feel comfortable justifying to the FSA that that is roughly what their costs are in redeeming a mortgage, but they would not have been comfortable trying to justify a higher figure. Other lenders have done, as you mentioned in your question, they've actually abolished the exit fee but replaced it with another fee, which in most cases just happens by pure coincidence to be exactly the same as the previous exit fee. Interestingly, one lender that did that, Yorkshire Building Society and their subsidiary Accord, who originally abolished the exit fee of £199 and replaced it with a mortgage administration fee of the same amount, 2 days later, after they'd seen what other lenders were doing, cut that fee from £199 to £90, which again tends to suggest that these fees are what the lender thinks they can get away with rather than based on anything else.
What other areas are they going to look to recoup some of these fees?
The margins lenders have on mainstream mortgages are pretty skinny. Now, I don't expect anybody to shed any tears for them, but that is actually a fact. So if they lose on average £200 per case, they are definitely going to look for ways to recoup that. The main options are going to be either to increase an existing fee, perhaps the arrangement fee, or to introduce a new fee, or to increase the interest rate slightly. Now, on the basis of the average exit fee and the average life of a mortgage, which is about 3.5 years, if they were to recoup the lost revenue by way of an additional interest rate, I calculate that on average would mean they would have to put the interest rate up by 5 basis points, 0.05%. That just gives one an idea of how much impact it might have. So it's not a huge cost for consumers, but I think the big win for consumers is that things will now be much more transparent. They won't necessarily end up paying any less.
That was Ray Bolger at Charcoal. And to find out more about mortgages, visit ft.com/yourhome.
You're listening to the FT Money Show. Coming up, how to save money when spending abroad. But before that, we take a look at the conundrum facing investment trust boards. A couple of weeks ago, we reported how trust discounts have been widening since the beginning of the year. Well, now they've got so wide that many boards, I think about 50 in fact, may soon be forced to buy back shares to stop discounts widening any further. But who would buy shares back in a falling market? And will boards keep their promises or not? John McLeod spoke with Mick Gilligan at broker Killick & Co to find out.
So Mick, around 50 investment trusts have taken on discount control mechanisms to enable them to use share buybacks and so on to try and control discount volatility, but discounts seem to keep widening out. So would you say that the discount control mechanisms simply don't work?
Well, I think it remains to be seen whether that they were. I think there will be specific cases where they will. But it very much depends on the underlying assets. So, for example, where you have illiquid underlying assets, for example, property, then it becomes more difficult for the fund manager to control the cash, to liquidate properties to be used in order to buy back shares in order to meet the discount level that they've sort of set for themselves. So I think it's going to be more difficult with the illiquid asset classes like real estate and private equity. But I think for the more liquid, like large cap equities, there's no reason why they shouldn't be able to maintain the discounts that they've set for themselves, the discount levels. The standout example would be an investment trust called Personal Assets, managed by Ian Rushbrook. And this is an example of a trust that has consistently bought back stock at very tight discounts, typically 2 or 3%, and has consistently issued stock at premium of around 2 to 3%. And despite the fact that it sits in a sector where it has probably been one of the worst performers on a relative basis because the fund manager has been quite cautious in a rampant bull market. So relative performance doesn't look fantastic, yet it has managed to maintain a very tight discount because the market knows that it will not tolerate a wide discount.
Okay. And with the F&C Commercial Property Trust, they may be forced to schedule an extraordinary general meeting if the discount remains above 5% for 90 days. Do you think it's a risk that a trust will be wound up?
I don't think there's much of a risk that it will be wound up entirely. I think they've got a few weeks to go from here before they're completely in breach of the discount control mechanism that they laid out. And I think it's unlikely they will get the discount back to where it needs to be within a couple of weeks. However, the reason I don't think it would wind up completely is that primarily because Foreign and Colonial own over 50% of the vehicle, and I would be very surprised if they voted for a wind-up. What may be more likely is that there is some sort of tender or some sort of change to the way they're doing things around the discount just to appease some of the other shareholders.
And in general, do you think that that buybacks are the best way to deal with widening discounts, or are there other factors that could come into play as well?
I think there are a number of factors. I think there's nothing better than getting a good shareholder register at the outset. And what I mean by that is long-term investors who are clear on what the fund manager's objective is and are committed to sitting with them long-term, although that's clearly easier said than done. But I think one point I would want to make is that I think that for boards to focus too much on buybacks as a means of controlling discount is missing the point. I think the main point of buying back stock is to enhance the asset value for investors. And if I just use a very simple example, if you had a trust that only held one asset, which was Vodafone 100%, and let's say Vodafone was trading in the market at £1.50, and the trust was on a 10% discount, then why would they not sell some Vodafone at £1.50 and effectively buy it back at at £1.35 to enhance the NAV? So that's a very simplistic example, but you have got a number of trusts out there with very liquid portfolios that could do that and consistently add value by enhancing the NAV every time they buy back and cancel some shares.
That was Mick Gilligan at Killick & Co.
And finally today, with the pound being so strong, you may think you can go away this summer and enjoy a nice European break without having to think too much about what you're spending. But actually, we found out that lots of shops and restaurants are actually setting their own exchange rates, which are unlikely to be very favourable for you, so you'll end up out of pocket when you pay with your credit or debit card overseas. I spoke with Steve Lodge to find out more. So what's the problem here for travellers then?
There are a confusing range of charges for using cards abroad, but this one is actually a charge levied by retailers rather than the card company.
So you mean the retailer is actually charging the customer for using their card?
No, it's not, Charlene. It's not that sort of traditional thing where they say, oh, we're going to charge you 2% for taking that card because they've got exchange costs. With this one, they're actually imposing a conversion charge. Strangely, they're claiming to offer you a service, charging you in pounds, but then what they're really doing is giving you a not necessarily very good exchange rate.
Oh, I see. And how much can this cost customers then?
Well, it can vary between retailers, but typically up to 4%. And at worst, some people say that some transactions have been hit by as much as 7%.
What can people do to get around this?
Well, you're meant to be given the choice with these so-called dynamic currency conversion retailers. There's a mouthful. Between paying in the local currency, which is the normal way, and just letting your card company do the conversion back to sterling, or paying in sterling there and then being hit by this extra charge. Most experts say that you're actually normally better off paying in that local currency and letting your card company do that conversion.
Would you say that's always the case?
Well, most cards charge 2.75%. DCC typically costs you up to 4%, so generally speaking, you're better off taking the card conversion rate. However, it's not always the case, and there could be instances where your card company imposes a particularly high fee for currency conversion that you're actually better off paying in sterling and taking that DCC whack.
But I guess as it's lots of people don't actually know exactly what these charges are likely to be, it's probably safer for them just to stick with paying in euros or dollars. For more on all aspects of financial planning, visit ft.com/yourmoney.
And that's it for this week's FT Money Show. Remember, you can email your views and your questions to ask.ftyourmoney@ft.com. And we'll be back next week with another financial lowdown in downloadable form, hopefully back inside the studio. But until then, it's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from me.
The FT Money Show team and our producers, Blue Barracuda.